Good morning.
Good morning.
I thought those were hard words by Mr. Thoreau, to go after life whether you discover the meanness of it or not. That's a big risk, isn't it? Because life sometimes does appear to be mean. Today I'm going to continue our conversation on the seven principles. And I'm going to look particularly at the second principle. The first principle is that we covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. The second, justice, equity, and compassion in human relationships. Justice has the idea of a social structure, of administration, a society in which structures itself so that justice indeed can occur. Equity, to support justice, has the idea of being fair and balanced. Compassion has the idea of being able to suffer with, to be alongside those who suffer and be able to sit with them and be at calm and at peace. Relationships, I think, is a word equally as important. The way we relate to one another. We live in a pretty hard culture, I think. We live in a culture where recently we had to confront the fact that we as a people are involved somehow in the torturing of others. That's a hard thing. When I first saw the pictures of those who were being tortured, a shock went through me and I did not want to believe it. And I wanted to push those pictures away from me. But yet, every week I say the principles and I read the second principle where it uses the word compassion, that I am to be compassionate, I am to suffer with, I am to be able to be alongside those who are being tortured. To suffer equally to those who are being tortured. I am also aware that I am to feel compassion for those who are doing the torturing. We live in a hard culture. It also occurred to me that as I read those words, I would think, well, surely I can be compassionate and I can understand justice. And I can have a sense of what's fair and balanced. But then I started thinking about the stories that we have been talking about recently, particularly the story of Buddha. And we remember bit of the story we were talking about Buddha, where he left his home, he went into the woods, spent years into the woods, meditating, trying to understand himself, try to understand the sense of enlightenment, and coming to the conclusion that in order to love, we must understand. And in that process came to the point where he almost died and has a sense of coming back to life where the little girl fed him and fed him milk and gave him milk to drink, which brought him back to life. And even then, after that sense of enlightenment, he continued on in his journey, on in his meditation, and he came to the point where he was going to confront his last wall to experience enlightenment after years of practicing meditation. His last wall in which he could move to experience a sense of compassion. And I got to thinking, all those years, all that meditation to the point of death, and he still got one more wall to get to compassion. I don't know that compassion that he's talking about. I know compassion as I understand compassion. I try to be empathetic and I know empathy and we can suffer with one another. But have we moved through the pathway that the Buddha talks about and that he teaches? Because that is another kind of compassion, and I believe it is that kind of compassion that would enable us to have empathy with those who are being tortured. to be able to move through the shock of what our culture is capable of doing, and to be able to sit with those who are doing the torture and feel compassion, to take the thing that we detest the most and be able to sit there. Buddha, before this last meditation, says these words: as he's meditating, as he's moving through that last wall, he says, "O jailer, I see you now. How many lifetimes have you confined me into the prisons of birth and death? But now I see your face clearly. And from now on, you can build no more prisons around me. O jailer, I can see you now." So we know that somehow in that meditation, somehow as he's moving through the point where he can sense pure compassion, somehow he moved with inside himself and he discovered a jailer. He discovered somebody who has kept him prison, has kept him in the process of moving from life to death and death to life, and not being able to fully experience what it means to be human. Well, who is this jailer? What is this jailer? What is this part that resides within the human mind, within the human imagination, that keeps us from becoming our truest self? Who is it? What is it? Do I have the courage to move inside myself and see that jailer's face clearly? Eric Burns wrote a book called Games People Play in an early mid-1960s. It was a bestseller, and it was a fascinating piece of work where he analyzed the way people relate to one another, and he called it games, the games people play, how we spend our time with one another, how we occupy our lives. And he said that within those games, when people are playing games, they take advantage of the weaknesses of others. And he says how this comes about, he says that as a person's being raised, there comes a time when a decision is being made. That decision is being made when the environment is not fully nurturing and not fully caring for that child, and that child has to adapt to an environment that is not attending to it as well as it could. And is it at the point at that time that child makes a decision? And that decision that child makes is a movement away from his truest self or her truest self. There, at that decision, the jailer is born. Because it is behind that decision is the pain, is the agony of our needs not being met. Is the pain and the agony when we have need, somebody could be intrusive, or somebody could be absent, somebody could be simply not available for who we are and the needs that we have, and it is behind that wall that our truest self lives. But yet there's a jailer. And if we go through life and there's more of these occurrences where we begin to nurture and we begin to feed the jailer, but not being on a spiritual pilgrimage that moves us past that wall and having a sense of compassion for ourselves of what it was like to have been in a relationship that was intrusive or absent, that we have built a defense within ourselves, that we don't touch our truest self and we don't go there. How many of us can think of memories that we think of memories and we don't think of it anymore because we're not going to understand those memories, we're not going to go to those memories? That has been my history. That was my past, and it has no meaning for me now. Well, the teachings of Buddha says we go inward to find the jailer. He was dedicated to finding the jailer. He was dedicated to knowing himself so clearly that he could see his entire inner world with clarity. And it is through the understanding of who the jailer was, it was through that understanding that he teaches that we can love and have compassion. We also see something very similar to this in the teachings of that first century prophet, Jesus, and his teachings. We see him as he is beginning his service and as he is beginning his ministry. He was compelled to go into the desert to meditate, and he was there for 40 days and 40 nights. And as that story goes, as I understand it, he met his shadow side. He met that part of himself that they call Satan in those days. He met that part of himself. And that part of himself was inviting him to participate in a culture that was an oppressive culture. When you read that story, he was invited to become wealthy, become a ruler, to be ambitious. He was invited to participate in the value system of an imperialistic empire, such as we all are invited to participate in an empire. We all are that. How do we deal with that? Both the Prophet Jesus and Buddha teaches us that we must move through our shadow side. We must move through that side of ourselves that tempts us to live in a way that we know is not the way we want to live, to make decisions that we know we don't really want to put behavior to the decisions that we make and to do it anyway, to somehow numb ourselves out so that when we see images of the most detestable thing a culture can do, torture, we are no longer shocked. We can simply put it aside, and some of us might even say, well, of course it should be against the law. But if you have to do it, do it. Just don't tell me. Because if indeed torturing somebody means to save a million people's lives, just don't tell me that you're doing it. Just do it. And of course we're going to make it against the law because we're civilized people. When we do that, we are repressing something about ourselves that's preventing us from being pure compassion, pure justice, having a sense of equity. We are nurturing our shadow side. When we have our shadow side, is that what we could have been, but we are not? Initially, the shadow side is not unhealthy. As a matter of fact, it's quite healthy. We could have been many things in our lives. I could have been a teacher. I could have been a gym teacher and a wrestling coach. That was one of my first dreams. And my first dreams was I'd have 12 children for each wrestling class. You know, I could have been that. I mean, that was alive in my imagination. But I couldn't figure out how the genetics would just give me that stair stack of weight. That's okay. That's also our shadow side. What could have been? But I made a decision to go in a different direction. That's also part of what I could have been, but I chose not to be, and that's healthy. That's okay. However, there comes a point when the shadow side can become unhealthy. When I begin to say there are parts of myself that I don't like and I don't want to express, because if I express those parts of myself, I receive some kind of negative feedback, some kind of discipline. For example, if you see a young child who's angry, and every time that young child is angry, that young child is met with an anger from a much bigger person, so that child begins to internalize that anger, and that child will no longer express their anger, or they'll express it in an extreme way. If you share in your life the things that you want, the things that you like, and there's somebody in your world that uses that against you, you will no longer celebrate by putting that information out there. You will repress that spontaneity inside yourself. If you are born in a family system that has military people, one after another, and you're born into that family system and you want to be a forest ranger, but you know you need to move in this line in order to get mother's and father's affirmation, whatever it might be, you must do something other than your most genuine dream to be accepted by others. When that happens, we repress those parts of ourselves into the shadow side, and that is not healthy. That is the part of our being that we meet in our dreams, or that we meet in our fantasies, or that we meet maybe even strongly in our consciousness, that invites us to participate in a value system that we know is not good. That we know hurts other people. A value system that we know stands on the back of others so that we can live well. We numb that part of ourselves out and it moves to the shadow side so that we are not outraged. When in Boston they put up a fence and they say this is the place of free speech, free protest in the cage. When we see pictures of torture and we just shun away from it and we don't go out and protest and we don't demonstrate our outrage. When we know that there were people in Miami who were protesting and that they were shot with rubber bullets and they were hurt and they were being harmless in their protest. We no longer become outraged. And when we are not outraged at those kinds of offenses, we know that part of who we are as human beings has been numbed out. Both the Buddhist tradition and the tradition taught by Jesus are pathways to enliven our inner world, to bring us back to consciousness so that we can move and be sensitive, that when we see these things, we can sense shock. Can that happen in our culture? Are we so inundated with the teachings of our culture and the values of our culture, is it impossible to really follow the teachings that are in our spiritual traditions as Unitarian Universalists? Is it possible? Ann Wilson, she wrote a book called The Addictive Society and says that the process of our entire society is addictive. And as I understand addiction, and when I talk about addiction, it is anything that moves us away from our primary feelings. Anything that we use in this world that moves us away from our truest self is an addiction. Even our president has acknowledged that this nation is an addict. We're addicted to oil. Now, we know there's something to that because in Jimmy Carter's energy plan, look that up on the internet, if you look at that energy plan, as far as addictions go, it was the 12 steps. Look at Jimmy Carter. It was tough. It was hard. He said that in 1977, I believe it was, we had 77 million barrels of oil from other countries. He said, we will never import one more barrel of oil than that 77 million, and if we need to use more energy, we will create that energy within ourselves. And he created a policy to move in that direction. I don't know, could we have done it? Would it have been helpful? I think so. But we chose not to go in that direction. We chose to go in another direction so that 30, 40 years later, we have a president who says we're addicted to oil. Well, what's the primary, one of the primary aspects of being addicted is denial. Now, how do we deny this as a culture? Is our society in a process that creates addicts? But we consider that addiction, the behavior of that addictive process, normal. We don't look at it as an addiction, it's normal. Eric Burns' book, Games People Play, that was a bestseller. There are other psychologists that have come to the conclusion that when we look at our society, we see particular behaviors that are pretty commonplace. Virginia Satir, she's the mother of family therapy. Virginia Satir made this model up, and she labeled the model, she talked about the characters in the model as being the persecutor, the rescuer, and the victim. We look around our culture, we look into our family systems, we look into our childhood. That triangle has power in our culture. When we look at the movies we watch, when we see the movies, the central themes of a lot of the movies that we see are persecutor, rescuer, victim. It is in the fabric of our culture. After Virginia Satir wrote that out of her work in Wedschneider-Cruz, she came up with another model, and it was a model describing a family that is an addictive family. She said you have the addict or you have the codependent. Then you have the hero child, the child, the bright light child that receives all the affirmation from the family system, the firstborn. The secondborn, you have the scapegoat, who will do anything negative to get strokes, to get affirmed, to get touched, to get loved. The third born, she said, is the lost child, the child that sees all this mess going on in the home and goes and studies somewhere, or goes off and they stay by themselves. They're the lost child. And the fourth child she describes is the mascot. Have you ever been in a room where there was tension and the same person all the time creates the jokes? The mascot. I'm guilty a bit of that myself. The mascot. Do you ever look and you hear somebody talking about their family and say, I don't know where these two kids came from. I got one that's completely opposite than the other. When we look at our family systems, are there people in our family systems we can say, yeah, they're the black sheep of the family. I'm the black sheep of the family. That's that family model. That's woven into our culture. It is in the fabric of our culture. When that happens and when that is so commonplace, health, positive way of relating, has been repressed into our shadow side, and it emerges into a negative way, and it emerges into a way of relating to one another where we take advantages of the weaknesses of one another. And as I understand my culture, there's a lot of good things in our culture. I'm standing here, you're there. We talked about fishing in the meeting earlier. We'll go fishing, talk about going to a picnic. There are a lot of good things in our culture. But when I back out and I look at the movement of our culture, we create victims. Mm-hmm. We create scapegoats. It's just part of who we are. And we use that to gain advantage. The Buddhist tradition and the tradition Jesus teaches says the only way to deal with those kind of issues, the only way, and I know that's a big word, the only way, they teach that you must go inward, because that structure is the structure of your imagination. It is the structure of your personality. It is part of our identities. And that structure that we've internalized from culture, from mom and dad, to keep our culture moving, that very structure is the jailkeeper. And our spiritual path and our spiritual work is about moving inward and seeing the face of our jail keepers clearly. Seeing the tempter that Jesus faced in the desert, his shadow side that would invite him to live in another value system, which he could have been. He's a pretty talented rabbi. I mean, he could have run right up the rabbi ladder and been the high priest. He could have done that. He could have participated in that society. He chose not to. The Buddha, as we talked earlier, when he went into the wilderness and he went on his pilgrimages, twice where he was in a school, the teacher of that school asked him to become the dean of that school. They would have been good positions. He said no. In that tradition that Jesus teaches, he says the kingdom of God is within you. Whatever that might mean. It's not external. It's not getting Supreme Court judges. It's not doing political activity. It's not doing that. Whatever that is, it's within you. And that is where you must travel to gain mastery over your inner world. Another way what's going on in my inner world is what I'm in relationship. Do I have the same arguments over and over and over again, month after month after month? Do I have the same negative feeling states in relationship year after year after year, and they don't seem to change? Am I locked into certain patterns of relating to people that keep me stuck? If my anger was repressed as a child because when I expressed it I got beat up, do I continue to be passive aggressive? Because if we stuff our anger, that anger will get expressed somehow. Am I emotionally reactive when certain things happen? These are all part of that addictive process. These are all part of that jailkeeper. These are all aspects when we move inward. We must deal with these things that are in us. It is the only way, as Ann Wilson teaches, to be in the addictive process, but not be of the addictive process. It is the only way that prophet Jesus teaches. You're going to be in the world, but be not of the world. The Apostle Paul, a follower of that teacher of Jesus, teaches us in Romans, be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So the question, can we set aside and jettison the values of this culture, even though they're deep within us? The answer from our spiritual traditions is yes, we can. Yes, we can. We can work to find out how we are conformed to this world. We can do that if we have the courage to do that. And that is the beginning of the process of transforming our minds, renewing our minds. It is the beginning of the process that there will become a day when I see pictures of horror. Rather than shun them, I can sit with those people and feel compassion and feel empathy, which is not easy to do with people who have really suffered. Empathy is a hard thing. Compassion is a hard thing. Justice is hard. Being fair and balanced is hard. These are not easy things that our second principle moves us in the direction of making ourselves as that part of our way of life, our way of being in this world. It takes a hard decision to say, I'm going to follow this path, and I'm going to use this particular spiritual path to confront what's in me, to confront what I've internalized that's harmful to myself and to others. I believe we must choose one, not a jack of all spiritual traditions, but a master of one. Not riding on the surface and saying, yeah, all these traditions are part of our traditions and we're inclusive and we're to be tolerant of others. Yes, all that's true. However, I need to master one of these spiritual traditions that's in our heritage and some that are not in our heritage that we adopt as we go along in life. I need to adopt one for the transforming of my mind to be complete so that I can be other than in the value system that oppresses others. As Unitarian Universalists, our principles say we should be leading this movement. It's our way of life. And I think many of us are in this church. We do these things. But it just hooked me. The last wall that Buddha confronted to feel that compassion, he says, I see you, jailkeeper. I see it on the first and second. I didn't see it on the last. The last one. After all that hard work, it confronts me that I also need to do that hard work to be free.